Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise and get straight to the strategic core of the world's most complex challenges. Today, we are wading into the high-stakes, highly bureaucratic world of European Union enlargement. It is, well, arguably the most consequential geopolitical project happening on the continent right now.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the ambition is enormous, especially driven by the war in Ukraine. You've got candidate countries like Albania, Georgia, Moldova saying, we want in by 2030. Montenegro is even talking about 2028.
Pretty ambitious timelines.
Very. Yeah. But then you look at the EU's own history, right?
Yeah.
The average time it takes to join. Well, since that big 2004 Eastern enlargement, it stretched well over a decade. So
yeah,
there's this huge gap between what everyone hopes for and the reality on the ground.
Okay, let's unpack this tension. Our mission today for this deep dive is to really examine that friction. You know, the geopolitical urgency,
yeah,
this dream of a bigger, maybe reunified Europe versus the, let's face it, structural inertia in Brussels. We're focusing on three main things.
Mm.
First, the total breakdown of EU conditionality, how the rules just aren't working, and we'll look really closely at Jordan for that. Second, the massive hurdle of unresolved conflict, using Moldova and Transnistria as our case study.
Right.
And finally, some genuinely radical ideas out there to try and simplify this, well, deeply dysfunctional accession process.
And before we jump in, it's probably worth remembering the foundational challenge here, the Copenhagen criteria.
Mm.
I mean, you can't even really start this journey unless you commit to democracy, rule of law, a working market economy.
The basics.
The basics, exactly. And critically, you've got to adopt the whole EU rulebook.
Right.
That's the 35-chapter Acquis Communautaire, basically everything the EU stands for in terms of rights, laws, standards. It's huge.
And even if a country manages that massive lift, the procedural hurdles are just brutal, aren't they? You need everyone in the council, all the member states, to agree unanimously, plus the parliament's consent, and then every single national parliament has to ratify it.
Every single one. Any country, big or small, gets a veto right at the finish line.
Yeah.
It's tough.
So maybe let's quickly review where things stand now. Who's actually in the queue?
Okay, so right now there are 9 official candidates. You've got Albania, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Georgia, Moldova, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Serbia, Turkey, and Ukraine.
Quite a list. But progress is pretty uneven, right?
Extremely uneven. Montenegro, technically, is out front. They've opened 33 chapters, provisionally closed 7. Albania is also moving along, opened quite a few chapters too, though none closed yet.
But then you have others.
Yeah. Then you look at, say, North Macedonia. They finished screening 2 years back, still waiting for proper talks to begin. And for Georgia and Turkey, well, their processes are effectively frozen right now.
Let's talk about Georgia then, because that seems like a really stark example of things going wrong.
It really is. It stands out, I think, is a near-perfect case study of this conditionality failure. So rewind to June 2022. Georgia gets this European perspective, but unlike Ukraine and Moldova, who got candidate status straight off, Georgia got homework. 12 specific conditions.
The idea being that this would push them to reform.
That was the idea. But by autumn 2023, the European Commission basically reported, look, key things like getting oligarch influence out of politics, fixing the judiciary, easing political tensions. Not much happened. They'd fulfilled maybe 3 conditions out of 12.
Only 3.
Yeah, something like that. But then, in this major pivot, December 2023 rolls around, and Tbilisi gets candidate status anyway.
Despite not meeting the conditions, how did that play out?
Well, this is where it backfired.
Mm.
Spectacularly. Instead of motivating the ruling party, Georgian Dream, to actually reform, they seem to take it as a green light. Like, okay, the rules don't really matter.
So they doubled down.
Exactly. They intensified authoritarian practices. They brought back that really controversial foreign agents law, the one activists call the Russian law.
Mm-hmm.
They pushed anti-LGBTQ+ legislation.
And didn't things completely unravel after their elections last year?
Completely. After the October 2024 parliamentary elections, amid reports of, well, massive fraud, the ruling party just announced unconstitutionally, mind you, that they were suspending Georgia's path to the EU. It violates their own constitution, Article 78.
That's staggering, especially after years of EU money and support flowing in. How do our sources explain that failure, particularly the failure of the EU's civil society support?
Well, the analysis really digs into this, using 3 concepts around democracy support, focusing on how the EU dealt with civil society organizations, CSOs.
Okay.
First, a failure of what they call social embeddedness. Basically, the EU's money and attention, it wasn't really inclusive. It went mainly to the established, well-known CSOs, the ones often dependent on donors. Researchers called it performative inclusion. It kind of sidelined the real spontaneous movements on the ground.
So backing the usual suspects, the ones who looked good in reports but maybe didn't have deep local connections.
Pretty much. Second, there was a failure of social empowerment. Brussels tended to sort of export its own prepackaged technocratic ideas about governance. CSOs were often treated like, well, apolitical contractors hired to implement reforms, rather than as critical political voices, you know, watchdogs rooted in what people actually wanted locally.
Right, not empowering them to challenge things.
Exactly. And the third failure was social accountability. A lot of these CSOs, they struggled with public trust. And they weren't financially self-sufficient, so they were constantly chasing foreign funding, which sometimes pulled their priorities away from actual local needs.
And that dependency created risks.
A huge risk. It led to this dangerous co-option trap, the prime example being the Georgian National Platform, or GNP, which was the EU's main go-to group for civil society. The GNP apparently became quite elitist, and it ended up pushing this narrative of candidate status at any cost, even when the conditions weren't met.
Wait, they actually supported giving Georgia status despite the lack of progress.
They did. They put out a joint statement, November 6th, 2023, claiming Georgia had made visible progress and recommending candidate status. This was even though, well, everyone knew only about 3 of the 12 conditions had been properly addressed. They were effectively giving cover to the EU's own decision not to enforce its rules.
That's problematic.
It gets worse. Some CSOs within that established structure apparently became actively complicit in the democratic backsliding. They endorsed the government's pick for ombudsman Levane El-Seliani back in March 2023, even though he was seen as aligned with the ruling party. They also participated in these government-run selection panels for officials, like the head of the Central Election Commission.
So lending legitimacy to processes that were basically rigged.
It certainly looked that way. It gave a valuable facade of independence to processes that were likely predetermined.
Okay, so the lesson seems pretty stark.
Yeah.
The old top-down, donor-driven model just didn't work. It failed catastrophically in Georgia. But something else happened, didn't it? This emergence of youth protests.
Yes, absolutely fascinating. What we saw in 2024 and 2025 was this completely new civic force, youth-led protests, the media called them Zoomers or Gen Z, and this movement, crucially, operates almost entirely outside that traditional NGO world, the one funded by donors. It signals that the EU really needs to, as the research puts it, engage in some epistemic unlearning. They need to rethink who they support and how.
Is the EU getting the message?
There are signs of a pivot. They've proposed redirecting over 100 million euros in aid away from the Georgian government and directly to CSOs. And there's a specific initiative, Act for Georgia, launched February 2025 with about 1.6 million euros. But, you know, the key will be getting that money to the right groups, the authentic grassroots ones, not just the old guard.
Okay. So Georgia highlights the perils of conditionality failing. Let's shift focus a bit, southwest to Moldova. Here the problem isn't just internal politics. It's a literal ongoing territorial conflict, right?
That's right. Moldova's huge challenge is Transnistria. It's this narrow strip of land, about 4,200 square kilometers, along the border with Ukraine, home to over 360,000 people.
And it's been outside Moldovan government control for decades.
Since the early 1990s. And critically, it hosts Russia's illegal military presence. So this situation inherently complicates Moldova's ability to meet basic EU standards on governance, rule of law, security, you know, across its entire internationally recognized territory.
Remind us about the conflict itself.
It goes back to clashes between 1990 and 1992. Russia's 14th Army intervened directly, supporting the separatist regime in Tiraspol, the main city there. Now, there's this militarized security zone, lots of incidents at legal checkpoints run by Tiraspol, blocking access from Moldovan officials.
And the official peace talks, the mediation efforts.
They're basically broken. The main format was called the 5+2, that's Moldova and Tiraspol, plus Russia, Ukraine, and the OSCE as mediators, with the EU and US as observers. But with the war in Ukraine and Russia's obvious dominance within that format, it's widely seen as obsolete now. Talks on big issues, political status, security, they've totally stalled.
Yet economically, Transnistria isn't completely isolated from the EU.
No, that's the twist. The region actually trades quite a bit with the EU under Moldova's free trade agreement, the DCFTA, which has been active since 2016. So you have this strange situation, politically separate, under Russian influence, but economically somewhat plugged into the EU market.
Which creates a massive dilemma for Moldova's EU hopes, doesn't it?
It's a huge one. Can Moldova join the EU without resolving this conflict first? If you make joining conditional on getting Transnistria back under control, well, you basically hand Moscow a veto over Moldova's entire European future.
But letting Moldova join without the region...
That's also risky. You risk instability. You're essentially importing an active conflict zone right into the EU's borders, and you're potentially abandoning over 360,000 people living there. It's a really tough knot to untangle.
Are there any historical parallels? Has the EU ever admitted a country with this kind of unresolved conflict?
The precedents are really limited, and maybe not that helpful. People point to Cyprus joining in 2004 while divided. But the key difference there is that the opposing force, Turkey, was itself an EU candidate and, well, generally Western-aligned, unlike Russia.
Any other examples?
Some mention West Germany being a founding member while Germany was divided, but West Germany had this enormous economic engine. It could handle the cost of reunification in a way Moldova simply can't. There's also talk about maybe an international transitional administration, perhaps modeled on what the UN did in Eastern Slavonia and Croatia back in the late 90s, successfully reintegrating that region.
So what are the likely ways forward? What scenarios are on the table?
Well, scenario one, Moldova joins with the conflict unresolved. That seems unlikely just because the EU is generally very reluctant to absorb active conflicts. Scenario two, some kind of international transitional administration. Possible, but very complex politically and logistically.
And the third?
Scenario three, which seems the most probable, or at least the one the EU would prefer, resolution, or at least a clearly defined legal status for Transnistria before Moldova actually joins. That would obviously strengthen the EU's own stability.
So what should Brussels be doing to help make that happen? What are the recommendations?
The main push from the experts is for the EU to shift gears. Stop being just a passive observer in the talks and become an active mediator. Leverage its political clout, its economic weight, to counter Russia's influence there. Develop a proper, targeted conflict engagement framework using diplomacy, security tools, dedicated funds for reintegration, and crucially, be flexible with the Copenhagen criteria timelines, acknowledging Moldova's unique, conflict-affected situation.
Right. So the specific challenges in Moldova and Georgia are different territory versus politics, but both seem to point back to broader problems with the EU's whole enlargement machine, right? It feels like the system itself is part of the problem.
Absolutely. And that brings us to the third part of our discussion. The process for all candidates is just a bureaucratic nightmare. And recent attempts to kind of patch it up, like this gradual integration idea.
You mean things like the big Ukraine facility, the $50 billion, or the growth plan for the Western Balkans and Moldova, another $6 billion?
Exactly. These initiatives, while maybe well-intentioned, have actually just added more layers of complexity. Albania, for instance, now has 122 specific measures tied to its funding under the growth plan.
On top of the 35 accession chapters.
Right. They overlap heavily with the chapters, but they're run as separate systems. It just creates more red tape, both in Brussels and in the candidate countries, without actually fixing the fundamental blockage stopping countries from formally joining.
And that fundamental blockage, the real bottleneck, is this unanimity thing, isn't it?
It really is. And what's fascinating, or maybe frustrating, is that the need for unanimous agreement from the Council for every single little step, like opening or closing individual chapters, isn't actually required by the EU treaties.
Really? It's not in the rule book.
Nope. It's a working method the Council adopted relatively recently, basically since Croatia joined back in 2013. And it's what allows these small-scale vetoes, often based on bilateral stats that have nothing to do with the candidate's actual progress. The classic example is Bulgaria blocking North Macedonia over historical and linguistic issues.
So it's a self-inflicted wound, in a way.
Pretty much. Everyone knows the system is archaic, it's widely criticized, but getting agreement to change the rules and move to qualified majority voting for enlargement steps, that seems politically impossible right now. So experts are proposing some really interesting structural fixes that don't require treaty change.
Okay, let's walk through these. What's the first big idea?
The first is to create a single central mechanism. Basically, centralize all the progress tracking under the existing annual enlargement package report.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is key, those qualitative ratings they use now, like advanced or good progress or moderate progress.
Yeah.
They need to be quantified, turned into actual numerical ratings.
Okay, put a number on it. Why?
Because that quantification serves a critical purpose. The Commission would then be required to state clear target ratings needed for formal accession.
Right.
This takes away the political guesswork for candidates, gives them a concrete finish line, and importantly, funding conditionality, like from those growth plans, would be tied directly to improving these chapter ratings. It integrates everything.
Right. Makes sense. Connects the money directly to the accession progress in a measurable way. What's the second proposed fix?
This one's simple, but could be really powerful. Drop intermediate unanimity. The commission should just stop waiting for unanimous approval from the council for every intermediate step, like opening chapters. It should just run the negotiations using its existing general mandate from the treaty. Unanimity would only be needed, as the treaty requires, for the final decision on accession.
So stop letting individual member states hold things up mid-process over petty issues?
Precisely. Let the process run based on merit and the commission's assessment, saving the big political decision for the very end.
Okay. And the third idea, you said this one was the most radical.
Yeah, this is the concept of nominated member state NMS status. Here's how it will work. When a candidate country demonstrably meets all those target ratings we talked about, meaning they've done the hard yards, the substantive reforms the commission proposes NMS status through a treaty of accession.
Okay.
Now, if the council is unanimous at that point, great. Full membership, they're in.
But what if they're not unanimous? What if one country throws up a last-minute political veto, like the Bulgaria-North Macedonia situation?
Right. Under this NMS proposal, even if unanimity fails at that final hurdle, the country still gets full functional participation. They join EU policies, they get access to funding, they even contribute to the EU budget.
So they're basically operating like a member?
Functionally, yes.
Yeah.
But, and this is the key distinction, they would only have observer status in the council and the parliament. No voting rights. Not until that final unanimous political agreement is eventually reached.
Ah, okay. So it breaks the deadlock. It stops purely political blockades from completely freezing out a country that has actually done everything asked of it on substance.
Exactly. It changes the whole dynamic. It puts the pressure back on the blocking state rather than the candidate. And it reasserts the commission's role based on the treaties. Look, ultimately, simplifying this whole process isn't just about bureaucracy. It's vital for consolidating a wider European political space. The geopolitical context, unreliable U.S., Russia's aggression, China's competition, it really demands it.
So, wrapping up this deep dive, the big picture seems to be this major clash, doesn't it? There's this urgent geopolitical need to enlarge the EU, but it's fighting against the sheer weight and complexity, the structural inertia of the current system.
That sums it up well. In our case studies, Georgia and Moldova, they really highlight specific failures. Top-down, technocratic ways of supporting democracy can fail badly if they don't connect with genuine grassroots movements. And these procedural flaws in the accession process, they hand far too much power to forces sometimes external, sometimes internal, that want to block progress.
And for you listening, understanding these details, the rules, the debates around things like this nominated member state idea, it really tells you a lot about whether the EU is capable of learning and adapting as an institution. And that capacity or lack of it, well, it directly impacts the future stability and the strategic direction of the whole continent.
Absolutely.
So here's maybe a final provocative thought for you to chew on. We saw how the established EU institutions and the donor-funded CSOs they typically partner with completely failed to stop democratic backsliding in Georgia. So if the EU genuinely wants to succeed in this next urgent round of enlargement and really wants to promote democracy effectively, should it be focusing less on just tinkering with bureaucratic rules in Brussels?
And maybe more on finding concrete ways to directly empower those new, decentralized, often very effective youth movements we're seeing on the ground. Perhaps even bypassing some of those established, sometimes co-opted institutional partners altogether.
Something for you to think about.
Indeed. We'll leave you with that thought. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.